Hi, I'm Michael Cortese of Noble Spirit in Pittsfield, New Hampshire.
And I'm Charles Epting of H.R. Harmer in New York City.
And this is Conversations with Philatelists.
So, Michael, who are we going to be talking to today? What's on the agenda for Conversations with Philatelists?
Today we've got Gary Lowe of the American Philatelist.
And I actually knew Gary before he was the editor of the American Philatelist. He was first just a great postal historian and author, and then joined the American Philatelic Expertising Committee. He was the head of the APEX committee, and just saw recently that he took over the helm of the American Philatelist. So it's certainly a very accomplished and an interesting gentleman to speak to, I'm sure.
Great. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Speaking of news in philately, I saw that you had a provisional cover in Linz.
Yes. So next week is H.R. Harmer's 3,035th public auction. Going back to the 1940s. And the key item in this sale is what's called the Lockport cover, which is a provisional cover before the United States federal government ever issued stamps. A handful of municipalities across the country issued their own postage stamps that were accepted for local prepayment of postage. Lockport, New York, a tiny little town up on the up near the Canadian border, it was one such town, and ultimately the Lockport provisional, only one of them survived. Only one of them on cover exists to this day. A stamp was issued in 1846. So in the last 170 some odd years, a complete second example has never come to light. Interestingly, there is a cover that has little tiny fragments of the stamp still attached to it. But again, after 174 years, if I did my math correctly, only one example of the Lockport stamp has ever been discovered by a collector. And that cover will be sold next Friday, August 7th.
Wow, that's exciting stuff. You'll have to keep me posted.
Absolutely.
On that.
Absolutely. You know, this item hasn't been sold since 1989, so 31 years. It hasn't been on the auction block. So where the hammer price will end up is really anyone's guess.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, was what's even the estimate?
we're starting it at $100,000, mm-hmm. and just keeping our fingers crossed, and we'll see where it goes from there. Again, when you have these things that are unique and haven't been seen in decades,
right.
It's really anyone's guess. It's one of the fun parts of auction, is it's not really for us to determine what it's worth. It's for two bidders to determine what it's worth.
Yeah, you get enough people in the room who want it, it could go for absolutely anything.
Exactly. In the virtual room,
forgot about that. Yeah.
it's very exciting. It's one of those items that when I was first getting into philately, I heard about this cover. I never dreamed that I would be holding on to it myself. So being able to return this to the philatelic market, again, after 31 years of being locked up in a collection, is a real privilege.
That's exciting stuff. Okay, here's Gary. Let's just bring him in.
Hey, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
Greetings.
How's it going?
I'm keeping busy.
It's nice to finally meet you. Been a while. Feel like we know each other somewhat digitally, but haven't actually met in any regard. And congratulations on your move to the American Philatelist.
Well, thank you. It's going to be a fun ride.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's very exciting to see your name on that masthead now. I'd say I think that speaks well for the future of the magazine.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I have some ideas in mind, as you might imagine, and some of which I'm sure we can talk about if that's a direction you care to go in.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
I was going to start off by just asking how long have you been with the APS in any degree?
Well, I joined a year ago in June as director of expertising, and then this rotation at the APS came up, and I find myself in a different chair, but actually probably a more familiar chair, because I've been writing for a good bunch of years now.
Even before you joined the APS as a staff member, I knew you as Mr. Postal Historian and Mr. Philatelic Author, so that I think it's a perfectly fitting role for you to step into.
Yeah, I will tell you, I am excited. I really am. I started off with a very solid base. Several of my predecessors, going back even before Barb Bowl, really built a very solid publication, and I've got an opportunity to shape it a bit differently, add my own 2 cents worth here and there. A lot of the changes we're going to be making are much more operational than they are content. With my business background, part of my charter is to really put the AP on a sound business-like footing and be less dependent on member dues as a subsidy for running this journal. So I've got some business issues that we need to make improvements with. But there's just a world of opportunity out there for communicating with this hobby. And I know that as a consequence of the COVID crisis, we are facing a renaissance in philately. And I find that really exciting. I really do. Because there are several things going on. You've got collectors who never had the time to devote to their hobby or as much time as they would have wanted, now have enforced opportunity, I guess, because of self-isolation and all of that. You've got lapsed collectors who are now returning to the hobby. And I think we're actually starting to see the beginning signs of that in a membership strengthening, where applications have been pretty strong for a couple of months. So that's a second element. And the third element is people who have not been stamp collectors before, but are now interested in the hobby. They are seeing so much of the activity out there on the web, and this conversation that we are having right now is a perfect example of the digital present and digital, I'm convinced, a digital future, a much more interactive, connected future digitally for all of philately. And that's just introducing people that never really had considered the hobby or never seriously considered it, now joining in. So we've got these three separate platforms where the level of interest in the hobby is really expanding. And I guess I see my role at the AP as seeking to capitalize on those opportunities by coming up with new ways to connect and communicate with those three groups.
And when you talk about the digital revolution, that leads right into something I wanted to ask you about, because 30, 40 years ago, the editor of the American Philatelist had a magazine to put out every month. That was their role.
Yep.
Now stepping into this role, you're not only dealing with putting out a print magazine on a monthly basis, but you've got so many other ways to engage people, whether it's through exclusively digital content or through the APS has had these great stamp chats for the last couple of months. You know, what is it like for you to balance? Again, there are people who anticipate that magazine arriving in their mailbox every month. And then there's other people who are looking for that next, those next steps of interactivity and of, conversation with people. Mm-hmm. What is it like for you balancing all the, again, you've got a lot more hats on now than an editor would have had a couple of decades ago.
Well, we need to be careful in defining roles in this new reorganization, because when Tom Lobig moved over from being the editor over to director of membership, he took with him his digital portfolio. So the website and things like stamp chats remain with him, and he's got the staff to do that. So Tom and I are really joined at the hip when it comes to content. My role, as well as his, is to shepherd the development of philatelic content. How it gets disseminated, if it comes in as an article, obviously it's going to start its life that way. Although I will tell you that we've had a few submissions that didn't look like they would fit all that well in the magazine, what would be ideal for a web presence or as part of a newsletter or something like that. So this joined at the hip concept, while it's just 3 weeks old, literally, is already starting to work out. One of the opportunities I see is in helping the APS by leveraging the print content that I'm responsible for and spreading it over to Tom's area, where he's going to figure out how it gets distributed and displayed. But I've got to make sure that we keep feeding him. Now, he's got his own people who are going to be developing their own content, but it's really important, just from an efficiency and an effectiveness standpoint, for me to make sure that what comes into us, which is historically the traditional way that content arrived at the APS, and make sure that it gets disseminated really thoroughly. So we've got this yin yang thing going between Tom and I, and I'm really optimistic about that.
Yeah, it sounds like a great relationship there.
Well, we joined within 2 weeks of each other last year, and we've become really good friends. And between the two of us, I think we really get the other, so that we do work effectively together.
Mm-hmm. How many people write for the American Philatelist?
Oh my! Well, all of the directors write a column. Mm-hmm. So you've got between the seven of us and the executive director, Scott English, there are 8 regular contributors to columns. There are 2 new issue sections, one of which is done by an outside author. That's the worldwide. We've got, I'm pursuing 1 or 2 opportunities to author the United States new issues. And then there are the articles, which come from a variety of sources. Now, those are not necessarily regular repeat authors, although some of them have been appearing in the AP literally for decades. I was just on the phone with one author who has a couple of new ideas he wanted to chat about, but he's written a couple of books. He's been in the AP 6 or 7 times. So we do have regulars like that. And then there are the one-off events or folks that, you know, submit something every 5 years. But there are like literally hundreds of those folks. And then there are the people that submit in a different fashion. And Charles, you're one of those, of course. We have a relationship with the U.S. Philatelic Classics Society, and they provide us with a series of brief articles, I guess, at the beginning of the year. And we select them as is appropriate for a particular issue. And Charles, I guess you found out this morning or yesterday that you're
last night, and you'll have a response from me by the end of today about that. I wrote that so long ago, I forgot what it was even about, to be honest.
Yeah, but so no, we do have relationships with authors through the various philatelic societies. The Classic Society, I think, was the first of the organizations with which we established a relationship like that. Well, we've got several more in the works, and I've got a few ideas for others as well. So the specialized societies are really among the building blocks of our editorial content, and I'm looking to emphasize that. So we've got a lot of authors. They come to us in many different fashions.
When you start to talk about the specialized societies, I think one of the – and I would love to hear your take on this, because it's maybe my most pressing question for the editor of the AP – if you are in the Classic Society, or if you're in the First Day Cover Society or the Postal Stationery Society, the editor has a pretty good idea what the membership wants to see. The American Philatelic Society covers everyone. It's one of the few, you know, the AP and Linz and maybe the Collectors Club Philatelist are the only major publications in the U.S. that have to appeal to everyone. So how do you balance the breakdown of U.S. versus foreign articles, classic versus modern new issues, postal history versus stamps versus production methods. You're really trying to cast the widest net possible of any editor.
Yeah. How do I balance it is not yet. I'm working on it. But you're right. With a diverse audience, you have many different kinds of types of interest and levels of interest, from somebody with a casual passing interest to somebody that's got a deep dive interest and would normally be part of a specialized society or study group. And how do you please somebody like that, as well as the generalist or somebody who might be a specialist, but not in the area that a particular article is about. So it represents some real challenges. And truthfully, I don't believe we've got enough information yet to make effective decisions like that. So one of the things I am starting, and it will emerge, I believe, next week or the week after, every time we publish an issue, we are going to provide our readers, both in the magazine and through our newsletters, with a link towards a Survey Monkey survey, where they will be able to give us information. Did you read the article? If not, why not? If you did read it, tell us your thoughts about it. We will be soliciting that kind of feedback from the membership. You're going to get a skewed sample, of course, because the only people that respond are those that loved it and those that hated it. So, you know, everybody, the great silent majority is going to remain silent. But I think if we start gathering information like this, we will be in a position to better understand what our members are seeking, what they are seeking to avoid. And, you know, you can't please all the people all the time, but something should be able to please all of our members all of the time. And that's the kind of balance I'm seeking to accomplish. Look, we've got two jobs, or one job with two solutions when it comes to how you fill the magazine. For example, why are these people members of the APS? Because they are, before anything else, they are stamp collectors. Their primary goal is to fill album spaces or enhance their collection or add to the material they're going to use for exhibiting. We have two ways of assisting them. One way is by educating them about the areas that they are interested in. And you do that through articles and new issue information and letters to the editor and all of that content-related value add. So that what are we trying to do? We're trying to produce an informed consumer. They know what they want to collect a little bit better. They know more questions to ask, and therefore they become more knowledgeable collectors. The other thing that we do, and maybe this hasn't been emphasized enough, but it is sure going to be under my editorial management here, is we have to facilitate our members getting through to folks like the two of you, the sellers who help them fill their albums and add to their collections. We need to be an effective channel across all of our platforms, not just the AP, to guide users, to guide collectors to the best resources for their particular collecting needs and collecting styles. Some people really need to know who the best approval vendors are out there. Some people need to know who are the best specialized vendors, who are the right auction houses, how do I deal with these various different types of providers of philatelic material for them. So there's lots of opportunity for the APS through both the American Philatelist and through our digital web content and all of that to help guide our members, our consumers, to the best resources for their needs. And that's something that we're going to be emphasizing going forward. So I'm really excited about that. Charles, perhaps you'll be interested to know that where I see the greatest opportunity for us to help collectors in this regard is through the auction houses. I think we do a pretty decent job when it comes to stamp dealers. I see there are several opportunities for assisting collectors to find auction firms that will really meet their needs as well.
And I think it's one of those things where if I think that it's mutually beneficial that if a collector goes to the APS or goes to the digital content and is directed towards an auction house and then has a positive experience, they'll be a more willing and more excited collector moving forward, and they'll renew their membership. And I it's fantastic to hear, because I really think that, again, if everyone works in harmony, it could really create a great overall, very enriching experience for the collector on all levels.
Technology is here to make collecting easier, make it less frustrating. And that sounds like a terrific direction.
Yeah, well, we've got two things we've got to do to achieve that, though. We have to establish really close communications, really close ties with auction houses at all level in the commercial stack. And there are different types of auction firms for different purposes and that are able to meet different needs among different collecting groups. So we've got to do something much more effective in establishing these communication links with all of these auction firms. And then we have to create multiple platforms across all of our platforms to facilitate that connection between the information that we now have and the collectors. So I will be working with Tom going forward, Tom Lobig, and making sure that we've got web pages and news in our newsletter bulletins that will alert collectors to all kinds of information that we haven't been as effective as we need to be going forward, and just create that linkage. So it's really important. If we're gonna fulfill the needs of our members, to educate them and then to connect them properly. And I see that as a big focus of mine. So I don't know that there's gonna be any breaking news about that. It's just gonna be an evolutionary thing rather than an unveiling of some massive project. And I don't envision it going that way. But just over a period of several months, once I wrap my brain and my arms around my new responsibilities, that's one of the areas where I'm going to be focusing a large part of my attention to make sure that we can enhance the value that we deliver to two groups, our member collectors and our member dealers. And, those member dealers, our advertisers, are critically important to us. I want to make sure that we are more valuable to them, because that's going to meet the needs of our membership.
Right. Yeah. Really strengthen the value of that the APS brings to each individual that is a member.
Yeah. Well, look, we've got, as I'm increasingly discovering, we've got an incredible reach. We've got some 28,000 members. Our readership is much broader than that. And now with all of this interaction through different internet resources, there's an audience out there that never saw us before that is now discovering us and adding literally thousands of viewers over, cumulatively over all of these different episodes and events. So we've got an incredible reach. I don't think there's any other publication that has quite the reach that we do. And certainly we're the largest collector organization on the planet. So we have a responsibility with all of that reach to make sure that what we're reaching them with is important and worthwhile and interesting. It's got to be fun. It's got to be engaging. We can go into some of the pedantic stuff and get into all kinds of you know, analytical philately articles for those that care about it, but it needs to be targeted to the kind of interest level that our diverse membership has. Not an easy task.
Right. Just a little anecdote on that subject. One of the funniest things I realized, I was dealing with a Philippines revenue collection several years ago, and I found out that the Philippines revenue catalog was serialized in the AP. My numbers may be a bit off, but I believe it was in the late 1950s. It was over the course of, I think, 12 issues. Okay. The AP ran just a listing of Philippines revenue, you know, its own numbering system. And fortunately, the AP has come a long way since then at providing content that is engaging. And again, there's always going to be the people who want the analytical stuff or the, you know, the more mundane listings of minor varieties. But, you know, I certainly am glad that we've progressed past that stage of the magazine's history.
Well, if you ever want to go back to it, of course, the entire, the complete run from the late 1890s to date of the AP is online and available. And historically, that's been a member benefit. But during the COVID crisis, one of the things that the APS has done is made all of that digital content available for free. You do not have to be a member. So people that are stuck at home and want to do research can get behind what used to be a members only wall and do that research. Hopefully they'll find enough value that they will become members. Obviously that's part of our objective, but we are a 501c3 educational institution. We are a public instrumentality. Our library is open to the public. We have an educational responsibility, and I don't forget that for a minute.
That resource, those back issues are invaluable. That is one of the – I've spent so many hours, even if I'm not looking for anything in particular, just pouring over – pick a random month and a random year and pour over. Yeah. It's really a wonderful resource for collectors.
I'm glad to hear you see it that way because, yes, it does serve those two purposes. Both the laser focus and the Brownian motion bouncing off different issues. So I'm glad to hear you say that, Charles.
That initiative that that the APS took in making it the archives free for non-members, has that seen a big increase in members because of that?
It has seen. It's always hard to figure what the right. driving force is, but our monthly new applications have been very strong for the last 3 months. And, you know, which aspect of how we've reacted to the COVID crisis is, it's hard to isolate. But cumulatively, between making resources like that free and all the stamp chats and webinars that we've been hosting and Summer Seminar online was an incredible success. It generated twice as many attendees as we were expecting. Think about it this way. Last year, we set a record, I think it was, at 105 or 106 attendees at Summer Seminar. This year, we had close to 1,000 different registrants.
Wow.
10 times. And this was a month-long event. Summer Seminar traditionally is a week-long. So now we've got a month-long event, and we were able to hold the attention of the philatelic public for a full month, completely engaged in a whole variety of different presentations. We had many more instructors and lecturers than we had at a traditional in-place summer seminar. This is, I think, the first really confirming evidence for me that the future of philately has changed forever. And the digital component of this hobby is going to be permanent. You know, I hope the crisis ends as soon as possible. But once that's over, there will be some reversion to the mean. But absolutely, there's a critically important digital future to philately. I'm convinced of it.
Yeah, the fact that it was a month long really allowed everyone to to cover a lot more topics. I think that kind of speaks towards what you were saying of trying to please everyone, because it you got a lot more attendance because it covered a lot more things that people were specialized in or just interested in. It really, don't know off the top of my head how many courses in person last year there were compared to this many courses this year, but it, the span was incredible.
Yeah. And another aspect of Philately's digital future that I don't think we've yet paid enough attention to is the fact that all of these conversations, all of these lectures, all of these presentations, all of the stamp chats are in an archive that's available for future reference. Right. It's one thing to have a meeting and you learn a lot of stuff and you go home and you get your notes or whatever. Here, new people can access our YouTube channel. We have this C3A educational platform, which is where the summer seminar online material is being stored. If you signed up for that course, you have unlimited free access to the course going forward. But if you weren't able to attend, you can still spend $5 or $10 and register for one of those courses and play at any time. So it's a whole different way of creating content that has lasting value. And boy, that's just a new world for Philately.
I think it ties into the digital preservation of exhibits as well. And at least on my end, it makes me wish that we had these exhibits or talks preserved from Ashbrook or Chase or any of the forefathers. Luckily, moving forward, you're right, we do have an archive and a footprint of everything being produced today, which is invaluable to future collectors.
Yeah. But to your point about the old exhibits, do not forget that the APRL, our library, has many copies of old exhibits. You know, they are black and white Xerox copies, literally made on a Xerox machine. But a lot of that has been preserved. And if you access the Philatelic Union catalog, which is our online entree to not only the APRL, but I think we're up to a dozen other libraries in the United States, as well as the Royal in London, that contribute their records to the Union catalog. So we've got all kinds of information in there. And really, if you look up by a document type that's called exhibit, you'll be amazed at just how many old exhibits are there scans of Xerox copies, but the resource is there for research. So wonderful resource.
To sort of shift direction 180 degrees, given your new role at the APS and the certainly everyone's had a lot on their plate during these last couple of months, have you had any time to focus on your collecting? And can you talk a little bit about your own philatelic interests, your writing, your really what brought you into the hobby in the first place? But have you had any time to collect?
No, of course not. well, let's put it this way. I may have stopped collecting, but I haven't stopped buying. So I continue to acquire, but that's a purchase process. That is not my sense of what collecting is about, which is a deep dive. My collecting interests are bizarrely narrow, and yet I study the world, looking at things as a postal historian, which means to me something different than a collector of covers. Looking at the world through a postal history lens, I see that all of these wonderful artifacts, these covers and other sorts of postal artifacts really are a lens through which we can look at all of society. And history in high school and in college was one of my great loves, even though I didn't major in it, but I've always been interested in history. And the way it manifested itself in my life is I became first a cover collector and then sort of switched hats and really became a postal historian, a student of the material. I had the traditional beginning in the hobby 2/3 of a century ago, mind you, where my dad gave me his album and I took it over and started collecting. But the best advice my father gave me came in two parts. Save up your lawn mowing money, save up your snow shoveling money, and buy the expensive material. And the second piece of advice he gave me was collect covers as well as stamps. So I would go to stamp shows. I was at FIPEX in 1956 at the Coliseum in Manhattan. And I bought covers. I would spend $2 or $3 on a cover, which is, that no kid would do that. But my dad counseled me wisely. And, I've got this, it's almost an archaeological dig worth of covers that I go through and things that I haven't looked at in decades that I now start studying. So I got a great foundation from my father. And we are an unusual bunch, we philatelists. I have probably never run into a collector that I couldn't have an informed and fun conversation with. Even if their interests aren't my interests from a collecting discipline standpoint or from an area standpoint, collectors are just so willing and anxious to help each other. You meet the best kind of people in this hobby.
It's infectious when somebody's excited about what they collect. Again, yeah. I may have no interest in the country or the era or whatnot, but once they start talking, it reminds you of why you got into it yourself in the first place, and who can't relate to that?
Could not agree more. And let me turn that into a discussion on the AP again, because the reason that I have such great fun talking with collectors, no matter what they're interested in, is the same reason that as a member before I joined the APS, I would read the AP from cover to cover. Not because I collected all of those areas, but because I would get insights into how different people viewed their collections in different areas of the hobby, and I could incorporate that into my own collecting. So I don't have to be interested in the subject matter of everything that got published in the AP. I was still interested in learning how different people collect, how they view the hobby, and that view of the American philatelist, studying the hobby aspect as opposed to the philatelic aspect, just really drives home the point to me that we need to make sure that our articles are well-written and understandable, whether you are a specialist in a particular area or not. To do that does not mean dumbing down the article. It does mean communicating complex ideas in simple language. And one of the editing emphases that I'm going to be looking towards is to accomplish that. Not to remove the importance of the content, but to communicate it simply. And that's really the essence of good writing.
Right.
Michael, is there anything else you'd like to talk
about? With so much to cover, as Charles had said before, what do you feel is the most underreported topic in the AP that in the past or something that you want to definitely shine a light on before that you felt that needs it?
I'm not sure that I see anything that's really underreported. Mm-hmm. What I see is we need to establish a more regular balance among the material. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to manifest itself going forward.
Right.
But the idea is certainly in my mind. I want to make sure that we have something of interest to U.S. collectors, something of interest to worldwide collectors, which is the other extreme, if you will, mm-hmm. And then to collectors within different area disciplines, you know, the British Empire, the France and colonies, Western Europe, and those are very broad categories. I want to make sure that we've got adequate coverage of Asia. You know, if ever there was a booming area in collecting, it's the Asian marketplace. And I figure if we, the APS, could capture 1% of the collectors over there as members of the APS, we would double in size.
Right.
It's we need to be thinking about the rest of the world. This is one world now. The communications over the internet have reconfirmed that, if there was ever any doubt before. When stamp shows come back, I would like to see us have a presence overseas. And I don't know if it's going to be the Chinese market to start with. It may well be the Indian market. That is such a vital area right now. I've developed so many friends that live in India or come from India and now live elsewhere in the world. But Indian philately is just a booming area. There's this emerging middle class. It is a nation that is filled with great pride in its heritage. And what better way is there to focus on your heritage than through philately? It's just a wonderful vehicle for that. So I'm thrilled watching the development in Asia and the Indian subcontinent. And I think we can meet needs over there that, maybe some opportunities can be filled by the APS. And that's really what I'm thinking of accomplishing through the editorial vehicle of the AP and of the Philatelic Literature Review. There's a lot of literature being published internationally that working with Scott Tiffany, who's our head of the library, between the two of us, and we're great partners, looking to expand how we treat, how we cover international philatelic literature. So that's another thing that's on my agenda, working with other of my colleagues at the APS. So it's really very exciting for me. I'm having a party, I got to tell you.
Yeah. It sounds like you've got great people surrounding you, and certainly sounds like the AP is in really good hands moving forward. I for one, I think I speak for a lot of people in the hobby, are excited to see the next couple of issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Opening up the topics in the AP is definitely going to help appeal to a more global audience and could drive more members globally to the APS as well, which will be incredibly beneficial for the hobby in general. Do you have kind of an idea as to how you're going to reach out to globally to other collectors who aren't APS members and at least give them access to the AP to maybe bring them in, or anything in those regards?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I don't know that at the level of the APS we've finalized how we're going to be doing those things. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely spot on, Michael. We will be continuing to focus and expanding our focus on building membership really around the world, through different means of access to the materials that we have. Our website, which has been redone any number of times, but the most recent one just around a year ago, less than a year ago now, really has opened up with significantly easier access, a vast resource of philatelic material, great content that's on there. And there's no restrictions on probably 70 or 80% of the material there. So people can get to us just doing internet web searches, Google searches, and very little of it is really restricted. And if that content is of value, then we hope we'll be drawing in members that way. You know, Tom Lobig's new responsibility is membership, and he's got some very creative ideas. One of the things, if I have a criticism of the APS in the past, it's that we were not anywhere near as effective as we needed to be in marketing. And Tom's got a good, solid marketing background. And I'm looking forward to all the creative ways that he's going to be bringing forward to let the philatelic world and increasingly the non-philatelic world know what a great resource we are at the APS and bring in members that way. We're going to be focusing on the academic community and others where intellectual pursuits are common, and make folks aware of our presence and of our value. And that's how you build membership. That's how you lock in existing members who don't want to leave.
Sounds like a fantastic plan. And we're excited to, at least I'm excited. I don't know. I don't want to speak for Charles. I'm sure he is as well. Excited to see, you know, how it executes.
Well, stay tuned.
I think again, given the last couple of months in quarantine, there's great momentum. And again, echoing Michael, really excited to see how you guys build on that, keep that momentum going. And you're right. It's not just the digital future. It's a digital present. I think you're right that we're not going to – obviously, we will still all go to shows and we'll still all read print magazines. But I really do hope that a lot of what's been implemented these last couple of months – continues moving forward. I think I hope that momentum remains.
Yeah. I will tell you that the level of interest, the level of excitement at the APS is really just so exciting for me to witness. You know, as one of the two new directors, if you will, we're a year with the APS now. It's just very exciting to see opportunity comes out of crisis. This is very clearly a crisis, but under Scott English's leadership, boy, we've capitalized on the opportunity. And he's been driving us very creatively to move forward into the future. And that future is sure going to be digital. But Charles, to your point, I can't wait for the shows to come back.
that first show back is going to feel so good. That's going to be such a relief when we can all do that again.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, Gary, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. This has really been enlightening. Again, I'm glad that we caught you sort of at the beginning of your tenure as editor. And once you've got a couple of issues under your belt, I hope we can circle back around and do this again.
Yeah.
Be my pleasure. Anytime, folks.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. And we'll speak with you soon. Stay well.
And good luck with your project.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Gary.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I thought that was fantastic. I thought that was fascinating. I love hearing what Gary has in store for the magazine. I love hearing that he's got such an enthusiastic and passionate team surrounding him. And it really sounds like we're in for an exciting new chapter of the American Philatelists, 140, 35-year history.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be exciting seeing how working in tandem with all the other executives there, they bring in new members, they secure the members that they have, and it's exciting to hear the new directions that he's thinking about taking the publication in and really help solidify the APS as a positive force in the hobby.
Absolutely. I heard a lot of echoes to what Alex said with us last week talked about using, you know, building on this momentum. And again, the fact that, yeah, we're going to go back, we're still going to read magazines, we're still going to go to shows. But, you know, really welcoming in this digital future, acknowledging that, it's going to be really tough to get Zoom out of our lives again after this. So I think it's great to hear that the APS is going to keep building on that, even as the world returns to the new normal.
Right. Yeah, it's good to hear everyone be on the same page, because just 5-10 years ago, I feel like going to shows, talking to people, not everyone was on the same page about how they thought the hobby would progress.
Absolutely. We need everyone from Alex to Gary pulling in the same direction to ensure the brightest future for philately. So again, it sounds like the American Philatelist is in good hands.
Yep. Yes, it does. And,
fantastic. So we'll be talking again next week. I believe our guest is going to be Wade Soddy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great guy.
Great guy. Great collector. Even greater guy, I would say.
Yeah. I would mirror those comments. Former APS president.
Former APS president, a specialist and expert in many of the earliest U.S. issues, as you know, sort of a jack of all trades as well. So I think it'll be really fun to get Wade on the line with us.
Yeah, looking forward to speaking with him.
Michael, now that we've gotten a couple of these under our belt, how can people listen to us? I'm sure there's people discovering us on YouTube, on Apple Podcast. Where can people go to hear us?
Those are the two primary ones, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. We're on Podbean. In a few short weeks, we should be on Spotify. And soon we'll be on Google Podcasts as well. We have, if people want to contact us, our own email address, philatelypodcast@gmail.com.
That's news to me. I didn't know we had our own email.
Yeah, I'll get you the password to that.
Fantastic. philatelypodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
And if people want to reach out to us, I assume we can provide links to all the platforms on which we are being hosted. So
absolutely.
That's great. And we'll just continue spreading the word.
Yeah.
Well, until next time, Michael, this was great. And I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, I'll talk to you soon. See you next time.